Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Pretty stunning moment. Do you see that gold necklace around President Trump's neck there? Well, Saudi King Salman presented that to the president. It's a gold medal. The collar of Abdulaziz Al Saud is what it's called, and it's the nation's highest honor.
Welcome to Politics, an audio product designed to make dumb people smarter, but will make smart people dumber. My name is Tim Batt, and I'm talking to you from Auckland, New Zealand.
Who am I?
Last time I checked, you were Jeb Lund, political journalist, hailing from Florida, the panhandle, the crazy house of America. Hey, Jeb.
Do you like how I just sort of insinuated that I'm the smart guy and then I'm getting dumber? Like, I'm one of the smart guys.
Because yeah.
I just got dumber there. And I'm
completely fine with being the dumb guy getting smarter to your smart guy getting dumber. That's, I think, how a relationship should work, Jeb.
It's like nice and symbiotic. It's sort of like a bivalve, but for two people.
It's like an intelligent seesaw is what it is. We'll meet in the middle and have no fun. Jeb, we talk about American politics and a lot about Trump because he's in charge of it now. And luckily for us, some juicy shit happened recently because Trump brought his national American politics to the world stage by having his first trip abroad. And boy, was it a doozy. There were so many people who were lauding him on different TV shows, saying that he looked presidential and he was finally reading his speeches from cue cards and auto cues and sounding like the real deal, a real American president. And then he just started engaging in all kinds of bullshit, like touching orbs for weird photo shoots and getting in handshake arm wrestles with the French president. What do you make of it all, mate?
I think everybody's been unreasonably down about the orb thing. My theory is that it's a device for harnessing orgone energy and then transmitting it to old, hopelessly repellent men with terminally flaccid penises.
Hey, we can live in hope. Just to explain, because I think a lot of people online would have seen the orb thing and just kind of cracked up at it because it was such a weird optic. But not really knowing what it was. It was an integrated, basically anti-terrorism threat center that's based in Saudi Arabia. And by touching that orb, they were kind of officially unveiling this thing and kicking it off. The photo, you've seen it. It's hilarious. I don't know how his media people managed to get him in that situation, considering that he is so obsessed with looking good at all times to the point where it looked like he was on the verge of crash tackling the leader of Montenegro to get in front of a G7 photo op. And yet there he was with a bunch of Middle Eastern leaders putting his hands on this glowing orb in a dark room. It was real comic book shit, and it was hilarious.
Yeah, and it happened to Bannon, too. You may not have seen it. There were some animated GIFs going around of, you know, various, Saudi princes kind of grooving and milling around Bannon, and he had this sort of like deer in the headlights look of like, what do I do? You know, it's
he was freaking out.
It's the Beach of the Saints. It's the, you know, just the whole fiasco just nicely illustrated the total schizophrenia of their Middle East policy. I mean, you have this selective Muslim ban, which is a Muslim ban, but it doesn't apply to countries like Saudi Arabia, which furnished, you know, the majority of our 9/11 hijackers. It doesn't involve a lot of countries that Donald Trump and his company have material investments in. But, you know, you've got a country with just absolutely grotesque levels of unemployment, no future for the youth except to be angry shit kickers looking for the first thing that gives them purpose. And then, you know, you have various princelings who want to get rid of the problem and they throw money at their unwanted relatives or ship them out of the country and just help radicalize this problem that everyone in the Trump administration tells you is this existential threat to the United States at every waking moment. And there he is, you know, just putting his hands on the jerk off globe with the rest of the princes there.
I mean, one of his like big lauded proud moments of this trip was the fact that he was, or he sort of took the credit for, though I don't know what the sort of State Department involvement with this would have been, but $110 billion weapons deal to sell a bunch of American-made weapons to the Saudis, which seems like a terrific idea in light of exactly what you've just outlined, that they're a huge provider of weapons via proxy, usually, that end up in the hands of terrorists and ISIS and places like this.
Or just, you know, fragging another house full of people and making all their living relatives into the same. I mean, we have no problem with Saudi violence in our name. And I mean, it just, like, you know, the whole story of the Arab Spring ends with, to kind of paraphrase a word choice that my friend Dan O'Sullivan used, it all ended with the sound of the safety catch coming off an American-made M16.
Dang, that's powerful. Although at least that ended in like a kicked up into a popular uprising. This seems like it's arming the people who are already in charge and not very good.
Yeah, I mean, although, you know, at the moment that we were celebrating freedom in Tahrir Square, of course, we were happily greasing the skids for it to be utterly crushed in Bahrain and other places around the Gulf, while our sec def was meeting with the same sort of autocrats that Obama was cheerleading the deposition of. And of course, you know, we saw what happened in Egypt. We got our sclerotic military autocracy back that's friendly to Israel and bombs and tortures the right sort of people. So, I mean, like, you know, we had a schizophrenic policy under Obama too. It just was slightly less comically shitty and stupid about itself. I mean, like, it still engendered contempt, but not like sneering, laughing contempt the way, you know, seeing good old racist shit for brain Steve Bannon trying to feel that beat with a bunch of people in like, you know, full dishdasha or whatever you want to call it.
It just shows up as well, the paper thin argument, ideology that they have, attitude that they have towards Islam and Muslims, because they keep issuing these things like Muslim bans. And I guess the only somewhat intelligible argument you could make is that they have cultural values that are incompatible with the American way of life. But then you go to Saudi, press the flesh, you make it the first country that the president goes to after being sworn in. And he's making business deals to sell weapons to these guys and, you know, opens up the dialogue by saying, we're not here to lecture you about your way of life and how you conduct yourselves. And it's just like, is there any more obvious the emperor has no clothes moment than that? That he like ran on this campaign of anti-Islam and anti-Muslims and keeps trying to introduce legislation to ban Muslims from America, and then he's fucking right there as his first trip out there. Like, he's there's no more naked a display of just pursuing whatever the lowest common denominator is of getting the votes and getting into power, and then quickly disregarding that at the first sign of just having to be steadfast in something. I mean, I think it's kind of good, ultimately, that this seems to be a sign of him shedding his Islamophobia, but it's fucking terrifying that the way that that is showing itself is $110 billion worth of weapons going to a country which, you know, realistically has attacked the states before.
Oh, yeah, and speaking of which, the next stop on the tour was Israel.
Yeah. You guys have got such an interesting relationship with Israel. So does New Zealand, actually. We just recently, in the last few months, got in trouble with Israel big time because New Zealand was a co-sponsor in the United Nations for, I can't remember what the resolution was, but it was basically telling Israel to chill out a little bit on the Palestine settlements.
Yeah, like,
and
please,
boy, did they not like that.
You can't keep building ranch houses on land that belongs to another sovereign people. Yeah. That confusing issue that's only been around for 40 years.
Exactly. We were co-sponsors, though, baby. Old New Zealand, thrown its dick around.
Way to go. Yeah, you're going to, I'm sure you're just there will be some angry mail about like some politician of yours who's now just the worst guy in the world.
Yeah, an anti-Semite, and yeah, totally.
Yeah. It happens. I mean, you know, you get used to it. I remember during, this is like completely off topic, but I remember during Operation Cast Lead, I was a moderator on a current events forum. I was actually a paid moderator. It was a decent gig, but I actually just posted what the actual death statistics were between people killed by Israel in bombing Gaza during Cast Lead and people actually killed by Qassam rockets in like the previous 8 years. And it was like this 22-to-1 ratio. And like a member of the board reported me to the ADL multiple times. Man, and she kept sending me like private messages, like, by the way, you know, here's a copy of the letter I sent to the Anti-Defamation League about you. And like at the time I was just way too tickled about it to not just be like, well, what did you tell them my job was?
These arguments are getting more common as well, where like there's sort of points of policy debate that gets so fraught because at the first sign of you sort of not being with the current hegemonial way of thinking, you know, you get accused of being an anti-Semite Nazi or something. It's fucking tricky, man. Stuff like that's popping up more and more. It makes me very unhappy.
It's being recognized more and more. but yeah, no, so they,
anyway,
they got there. Yeah, they got to Israel and Trump said, it's, you know, it's great to be here after I just got back from the Middle East, and Ron Dermer, the Israeli ambassador to the US, just like had this beautiful what the fuck face. And then, not to be confused with his resting fuck face. And then Trump confirmed that he was the source of, Israel was the source of the intelligence he leaked by going, by the way, that intelligence, which I didn't leak, I never once mentioned Israel.
Dude, when I saw that footage, because I sort of saw that headline going around, and when I looked at the video to, you know, you want to see those moments yourself, not just read the reporting around it. I was like, my first initial thought when I saw that was, this is a dude on the mental decline, like in a very serious way, because he was standing there with Bibi Netanyahu and the kind of press availability had ended. Netanyahu, I think, took a question or two from the press and answered it in the very smooth way that he does, and they were kind of going out of there. And Donald Trump decided that he didn't, it seemed to me, want Netanyahu to be the last person to speak.
Yes.
So he told everyone to shut up in the room. Everyone was like wrapping up, getting their cameras back in their bags. There was a lot of like chatter and stuff as everyone was bailing out of there. He told everyone to shut up and then announced, I just want to be absolutely clear, I didn't say Israel. And it was like, what the fuck are you talking about? No one said that you, dude, what are you up to? Oh, man.
Like, and it couldn't have been more obvious, too, that, like, I mean, if anybody, I doubt anyone was really in any doubt that he had fucked up and already done this, but it was on the level of like, you know, like when a 14-year-old boy goes into, you know, his bathroom for like a half an hour and comes out and like, and you're like, what are you doing in there? And you don't need to really ask.
Not masturbating, that is for sure. Can everyone please be quiet at the breakfast table? I definitely wasn't masturbating for half an hour, and I need you to know that. And it was, I just want to take a wider scope for those who may have missed that story as well. So that was it Russian officials that he was allegedly talking to and revealed some classified information about a hit or proposed plan to hit ISIS?
Well,
was it the Russian ambassador he was talking to?
Yeah, there was. It was Kislyak was there along with the Russian foreign minister Sergei Lavrov, and that was the White House visit that the American press was not invited to, and that a photographer from the official state media TASS, which has been used as a cover for spies in the past, was allowed in with all of his equipment into the Oval Office. And Trump told them about this very, he said, we have the best intelligence. It's so great. And it wasn't theirs. It was Israeli intelligence. And as it happened, it was somebody who, by like all accounts, was actually embedded with ISIS. So
right.
You saw like a lot of people kind of coming out and going like, well, that person's dead now. Which, you know, might just be for effect. You know, there's some other ways that intelligence might have been received, but you know, the imagery obviously works.
So other high points of the trip, he has also been joining the G7 members. And I mean, it's just like another day, another photo opportunity for left-wing media to throw around online. It was crazy, the handshake that he engaged in with Emmanuel Macron, the recently elected French president, centrist president, was just like this pissing contest of white-knuckled gripping between two dudes who refused to let go. It was the most insane thing.
And he lost.
Trump
lost. If you look at it, if you look at it carefully, like his knuckles are going white, and then his face starts to transform into a wince, and then you see his fingers go completely slack in Macron's hand. I mean, he cried uncle. I mean, Trump is the cuck here. He lost.
But to quote from a movie that I've seen 44 times now called We Are Your Friends, starring Zac Efron, are we ever going to be better than this, Jeb? Like, who gives a shit who won the handshake? That's like, this is some schoolyard bullshit conducted by a man who's, what's Trump, 70 years old?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right about the age, but like, I don't give a shit about the handshake. I give a shit that Trump gives a shit about the handshake. And if you establish those points, you know, and you lose, I'm going to roast you for that. Like, I don't think you're any less, like, if you went spearballed tomorrow, I'm not going to think that you're less of a dude because you don't have a thick, wavy head of hair, right? But if you had spent if we'd been hanging out since high school and you were always roasting guys for being bald and saying that they were unmanly, like, I'm going to clown on you on that basis probably forever, or at least for 5 years. I mean, at the end of the 5-year term, if I've endured 5 years from you, you know, then we're done. I'll no longer tease you.
I like that. You know, you're like, allowed to mock people based on the parameters that they have set out earlier on.
Yeah, I mean, if you're gonna establish these chicken shit criteria, and it's clearly important to him as this like empty gesture of masculinity, and you fail on it, then fuck you.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. And there's kind of like, I mean, all the stuff we talked about so far is a little bit silly stuff and weird optics and that, but there's some very serious fallout from an international relations point of view of this trip as well. In particular, and I haven't seen the latest on this, but there seems to be some signals that Trump is pulling America out of the Paris Agreement, which is a collection of nations coming together to try and tackle climate change. The agreement that they made last year, I want to say.
Sure.
We'll go with last year. Yep, good stuff.
This year is, to be very honest with you.
Yeah. I'm talking to you at 1 a.m. as well, and I know that you're frequently on a concoction of varying amounts of sleep and stimulants and what have you. The main bit of the agreement is that the agreeing nations are going to attempt to try and hold global temperatures to within 2 degrees C above pre-industrial revolution levels, and in addition to that, pursue action to try and get it within 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial revolution levels. Probably won't happen, but it's a solid goal that they have out there. And if basically America, India, and China don't subscribe to this, they're far and away the biggest contributors of carbon. America, in terms of like per capita, per head of population, is by far the biggest contributor of carbon to the atmosphere. So if America pulls out, it makes it very difficult for smaller countries to be a part of it. It's kind of the TPPA all over again. And it's just like, I read, what was the headline, which I think was in the Washington Post or the New York Times, was basically describing it as a dereliction of duty of American leadership, but if they do pull out of this. And as a result, people like Angela Merkel, Germany's chancellor, is saying that Europe kind of needs to fend for itself now and think about, and I'm paraphrasing, but almost a post-America future.
Yeah, and that I think that's also informed by the fact that, you know, like Trump on the stump said, you know, NATO is outmoded, we're not going to obey it, and we're going to get rid of it, it's crap. And the problem is that, you know, we're bound to the NATO treaty. It's not something that, like, you can just do by executive order. We're legislatively bound to it. And so, like, all of Trump's NatSec guys, for the most part, are... you know, kind of traditionalists in that NATO is a good thing. And it was kind of expected that he was going to come in and go, hey, NATO's still a good thing. And instead, you know, he was, you know, not palling around with Saudis, right? But like, you know, he's being very, very positive and outgoing toward the Saudis. And then he gets to Europe and he immediately goes, you know, hey, everybody here, you're not paying your fair share. Where's the money? And like later he characterized Germany as very bad because they're sending so many BMWs to the United States, which is like yet another, like, it, you know, it, piece of evidence in my theory that like every single idea Donald Trump has about governance comes from like 1988. It's like the Japanese are bad. The Chinese are trading with us and they're cheating and we're all buying German cars. But like,
he also doesn't seem to have a grasp on, I mean, look, I'm going to describe what's going on and then ask you where you think it's coming from. But whenever he talks about the NATO member nations not paying their fair share, he always describes it in a way like there is some war chest of money, some bank account that they should be paying into that they're not doing. That's not how it works. It's an agreement that the member countries are supposed to spend, from memory, 2% of GDP on defense, and that there are some countries who aren't doing that, who aren't spending quite that amount. Do you think... I'm sure it's a basket of both, depending on the issue. But do you think when he does these with this communication with issues to the public, he genuinely doesn't understand them? Or do you think he's simplifying them to the extreme so that he can kind of get the populace to rally around him because he's simplifying these complex issues fantastically into bite-sized little chunks, little sound bites that can be on the news?
It's a good question, but like in this case, I think he genuinely has no fucking clue what NATO does, because if I mean, like, you would think that this is like really cynical salesmanship for the U.S. population, but he's made all these promises that like legally he can do nothing about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the overselling isn't doing him a whole lot of good. I mean, you would think like, okay, the way that he frames NATO is he almost makes it sound like the United States pays for NATO and Germany is late with its NATO rent.
That is exactly how he describes it when he's talking about it in the press.
Yeah, and there's literally no way he's going to get that money. Like, he can never go before the American public and say, listen, I got our check. You know, the most that happens is, like, some of these countries bring their defense spending from 1.2% of GDP all the way up to a full 2%. And, you know, he can say, like, finally, the people of Estonia are paying, you know, pulling their weight, and like that's not a big enough prize to bring back. And
but this is the thing, and I'm not going to limit this to Trump. This is pretty much every politician ever born. They never stick to the end result of a statement that they make like that on the other side, because they've quickly moved into three other arguments that they're starting. But you never really see the resolution of those sorts of the Molotov cocktails that he throws out there.
Yeah, although in this case, like, you know, it seems like this is something that he heard and he misheard and he warped it around in his little Trumpy brain. And he's made this promise for so long that he refuses to back away from it because it's part of his brand. But I don't think anybody managing him at any point has said, this is a good take. You know, it just doesn't.
Right.
I don't know why, like, a strategist would say this works for you. I mean, because at no point has like the thing he's been complaining about existed. So the thing he's trying to promise can't exist either. And so he has to just like come up with more bullshit. And, you know, like the true believers are going to be fine. I mean, I remember I was looking through Twitter, as you know, during the orb thing, and all those guys are like, well, finally, he's got the Saudis on our side fighting terrorism. You know, that's always going to work for people who had no idea what the fuck the Saudis were doing this time last year. Have any idea who was involved in like 9/11 maybe, or, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood, or like, you know, who's making up like ISIS recruits. I mean, people who don't know that shit are gonna be fine. But like anybody who does read the paper periodically and who might have been well disposed to him, this is just like another domino that goes, and there's no, what's the fucking return?
Hard to say, but it does depend on the public's attention span to be able to follow these things through. And I just think it's non-existent at this point because there's a new fireworks show every day. Another little meeting that he had abroad was he got to meet the Pope, who gave him a 192-page letter about climate change, which was pretty amazing. And there were lots of like silly, you know, photo gags going around the internet as well, which, I mean, on the one hand, kind of unfair. A lot of them were showing the Pipers being very despondent and pissed off looking while Trump was smiling from ear to ear. You can get that shot if you want, and the press decided to roll with it. But I think more than anything, those sorts of events online, when they happen, those little flashpoints of publicity, those photos that get shared virally across the world like in a matter of an hour, they're an example of when you expend all of your capital with the press, you get everyone offside, anyone who's, you know, remotely centrist, you lose as well. Everyone just engages in this global version of Schadenfreude where they celebrate every misstep possible and pick the worst photo of you and share it around all their mates and stuff. And particularly getting the press offside. He's been lambasting the press since he's been campaigning. And any one of these opportunities, as president, you can't help but create so many of these opportunities. And they're just going to fuck you with them if you don't have any goodwill.
Oh, yeah. We definitely need to get to that in the next bit. But, I mean, there was a couple bits that, like, weren't just empty imagery that I thought were kind of, like, legitimate avenues for going, what's going on here? I mean, you had Ivanka and Melania not wearing, any kind of head covering in Saudi Arabia. And then they show up to meet the Pope in full widow's weeds. And, like, you know, you don't need to dress like that for an audience for the Pope, but it really did seem like they went to somebody at Bloomingdale's and said, what do Catholics look like when they're serious? And then their personal shopper went out.
Especially this Pope, I might add. You know, Pope Benedict, maybe. That guy was, you know, he seemed pretty dour and serious and a bit of an uptight asshole, but Francis is a good dude. He's loose. He's the party Pope.
Yeah, it was, you know, he's Jesuit. He hangs out with people who do bad things. He has to pick up good ideas from them. But
yeah,
but like it just seemed like such cynical pandering to like Catholic, you know, kind of work in the white working class voter that broke for Trump, right? Like, hey, listen, how reverently we're gonna treat this audience with the Pope. We're gonna get in full kind of like Wednesday Addams gear for it.
And yeah.
But at the same time, like the person that they just sent and was there for, I guess, like, you know, one of these meetings, maybe I can't remember, like so much of the coverage was on the fact that he left Sean Spicer out of the meeting. And Spicer's like the only devout Catholic and the senior members of the staff. Which is like,
oh, my God. I didn't know that.
Oh, just.
Oh, that sucks.
I mean, like, fuck Sean Spicer.
He's, but like, he's put up with so much shit. My poor little Spicy. He's the dude fronting this war of attrition every single day.
He didn't get
one opportunity to see the man himself.
He's doing it to up his Q rating and to wind up in the history books, and he doesn't really give a shit like all the evil things he's trying to cover for every day. I'm fine with him being heartbroken, but anyway, like so Spicer, who would have been like, you know, a plausible candidate to bring, gets left at home. But our ambassador to the Vatican is, of course, Callista Gingrich, whose husband has been married three times. And he served his wife with divorce papers when she was in her sick bed in the hospital. And at the same time that this trip was going on, that same husband was fueling the Seth Rich was murdered by the Democrats conspiracy theory. So you've got a guy.
Hold on. Sorry. Who are you talking about again?
Newt Gingrich.
All right.
So
yeah.
Callista Gingrich is our ambassador to the Vatican. So she wasn't married at the time, but she sure did help him commit adultery. And at the same time that you know they were visiting with the Pope, you know, Newt was out there going, you know, fueling the, well, maybe the Democrats murdered Seth Rich because he was actually sending the WikiLeaks info to Julian Assange and Russia had nothing to do with it. And like, just,
you know, who probably put up with enough shit to earn being the ambassador to the Vatican is John Boehner. Cause that guy from memory cried like a goddamn baby when he met the Pope.
And he smokes. So he could hang out with a lot of priests. A lot of them like to smoke, you know?
Well, there you go. Two things in common. Yeah. They both like the Pope and they both like to smoke.
Yeah. And red wine. I mean, he'd be very happy in Rome. Just, you know, just sitting out like a little under like a big Cinzano umbrella, you know, just having like a sangria and just smoking a Marlboro and just really taking the whole thing in.
Jib, let's take a short break. I'm going to go grab a cold beer from the fridge and we'll pick back up and, I don't know, probably talk about Russia, because how can you not these days?
When people are pounded night after night with that kind of frantic, hysterical reporting, it naturally shakes their confidence. And yet, don't get the impression that you arouse my anger. One can only be angry with those he respects.
Welcome back to Politics, a show about a show of people pretending to do American politics. Tim Batt back here, and Jeb, I want to pick up the point that you wanted to talk about earlier about Trump exhausting any goodwill that he might have built up in the media by being a fun clown by attacking them constantly.
Yeah, I was so... You know, kind of in a macro way, I've been going back and rereading a bunch of Watergate stuff, and I mean, this idea that that aggression toward the press is somehow new or reached a new low. I think, I mean, it's not new. It's definitely a new low. But I mean, the idea that we've gone from like courteous disdain to real incivility, only recently is I think BS, and I think we just have sort of short memories. You know, like at one point during Watergate, Bob Dole gave a speech, and I think it was 47 or 57 individual times in his speech he mentioned the Washington Post, and basically implied that it was garbage and manufacturing its information. I mean, if you remember the coverage of Watergate, it's all these anonymous sources, it's totally unaccountable. And this was a whole argument from Republican Party in general, that the press was this unaccountable beast in democracy that had gotten out of control, and its ability to use anonymous sources and its protection from lawsuits was making it an enemy of democracy. So this rhetoric is like 40 years old, but the way Trump kind of intensified that and took it into a physical place, I think, you know, didn't necessarily like, you know, it wasn't the cause of Greg Gianforte grabbing the Guardian's Ben Jacobs and like, you know, grabbing him by the neck and taking him to the ground and hitting him in the face. But like definitely the atmosphere for that has been heightened under Trump. Because this is one of those things that I would talk about with people who covered him on the trail for over a year. And it was something that I could see myself feeling. You know, I didn't necessarily go through it, but like you when you were in the press at Trump events, he put you in this sort of metal cage on the floor with your back to the rising stands behind you. And then he would point to them. And so they were kind of sequestered and they became a prop in his theater of glower. And he would say, "These people are your enemy." And I do know that women friends of mine who went out and covered this felt intimidated physically by Trump supporters. I definitely at like after he was elected felt uncomfortable once or twice around people when they, you know, I'd say I was the press and they would just sort of start yelling at me about being a George Soros backed,
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Like global fascist, whatever. Because I'm of a slight build and it's not that hard to knock me down. But like, you know, that kind of sensation I think has been broadly felt. And so like the Gianforte thing was just like a bridge too far for me. And like, I hope I'm not really sure where I'm kind of going with this monologue other than like, I hope other people who normally wouldn't have any sympathy for the press are like, maybe don't fucking ever touch them.
Yeah.
Don't touch
the
press.
Yeah. There's gonna be some line somewhere. And this is the he's a congressman who's just been voted in from the state of Montana, who was attacked on the eve of the who attacked a journalist on the eve of the election, who busted into a another different press interview he was doing and asked about his reaction to the CBO scoring of the new American Healthcare Act and fucking decked the dude, as we would say in New Zealand. Went at him, brought him to the floor, and broke his glasses.
Yeah, yeah. So what happened was Fox was setting up for, like, the guys, sort of the advanced team and the remote team. There's a producer and camera guys for Brett Baer's show on Fox. Were setting up for a thing that they were going to do with Gianforte. So he wasn't on camera. He wasn't conducting anything. Ben Jacobs came into the room and had his recorder and asked about the CBO score, which is a standard Capitol Hill question that you would ask a representative. Gianforte, who had has invested with some firms that have ties to the Russians, and The Guardian had reported on that, said, you know, are you from The Guardian? And then flipped out on him. And I think, you know, that might have been the cause. But whatever, you know, whatever was the thing that pushed him over the edge in that moment, like, it's absolutely unacceptable. So, like, Ben Jacobs wasn't doing anything inappropriate. I mean, that's pretty normal. You go up and you ask a question. Like, if he'd already had a mic in his face and a light and a camera in his face and Jacobs had done that, pushing him away and going, like, no, you know, excuse me.
Yeah.
That would be fine. You could, you know, put your hand on him and say, just a minute. But he came nowhere close to doing something that was unprofessional. And, you know, he did have his recorder on, and so we can hear what happened. And it seems very clear that Gianforte flipped out. But, like, you know, overnight, he raised an additional $100,000. They got a surge. And there were people, if you looked at social media, there were people saying, like, great, you know, he deserved it. When Gianforte won, he won by 7 points, which was much lower than expected.
And also, we'd just like to point out that I think there were a lot of people on the left who were hoping that this incident, because it was on the eve of the election, would swing it. But there was a huge amount of early voting in the state, right? So they couldn't, the electorate couldn't actually respond to this event in real time.
Yeah, something like 2/3 of the people had in Montana had already filed their ballots by mail or done early voting. And then allegedly, like, the Secretary of State's office got on like a record number of calls asking about how people could change their votes, but you can't do that in Montana. You can't vote absentee and then go in and vote on the day of and have your vote cast the day of, cancel out the previous ones. So those people were stuck. So he still won, you know, but within a margin that's encouraging for Democrats. But at that rally, there were several national news reporters that were there, and there were supporters going by the press table and pointing at them and going, snowflakes, snowflakes, and just doing this sneering shit that most people, you know, look, you know, in a crowd, you get fired up and you can all hate things together. You can have your 2 minutes hate. You can rail against Emmanuel, Soros, Goldstein, or whatever. But, like, most people generally don't have, they don't feel comfortable going and being aggressive individually to people face to face. Now, when they can't see the press, or when they can only see their heads maybe in a pen and they are kind of an idea and not a set of human features in front of them, it's easy to rail against them. But you don't really get that. I mean, and that's what is what seems to be increasing, that people feel a validation because they're being told that the press are essentially a treasonous entity that is embracing and emphasizing and facilitating an attack on them. And they're being told by the highest public servant in the land that this is okay, because the press, like, any one of them is basically a bad human being and un-American. And, you know, if somebody, like, you know, Greg Gianforte, literally, you know, he's been trained every day to not say what he thinks and not do what he wants because he wants to be elected. And he should have been a complete pod person. And the fact that he just went ahead and snapped, didn't apologize for it until after he won. You know, like,
and they actually, it wasn't a very sort of full-throated apology either, right? Like, they first tried to insinuate that Ben Jacobs was kind of the aggressor in the first version of the statement that I saw.
Yes.
I didn't actually see the apology.
Well, so that's the interesting thing is, so Gianforte is charged with misdemeanor assault, and if they, like, any defense that he has that deviates from that official statement basically will put down in a courtroom that this statement was a lie, in a way that like is slightly more kind of, I guess, damaging for them, on top of the fact that, like, Ben Jacobs has a recording that in no way supports their narrative of events. Now, it may not necessarily support his, but theirs is not borne out by what's on that tape.
And even more damning than that, the Fox staff who were there have come out in full support of Ben Jacobs and kind of like gave an account that was even more dramatic than sort of the account that Ben Jacobs gave himself
in terms of
how victimized Ben Jacobs was.
They were the first ones to mention the punching. He didn't, you know, he just sort of said, like, I got body slammed to the ground. They said he slammed him to the ground, started, you know, Gene Forte slammed him to the ground, started, you know, throwing punches at his head. Now, maybe
it's Fox. This isn't MSNBC reporters.
No,
and overheard this happening.
And that's not local Fox. That was a national, you know, a producer team from the home office. So, you know, those are the people who are most steeped in the culture, the Fox war room culture. And they were there going, the Republican candidate's narrative is bullshit. And we side with this other guy, you know, this other member of the of the press.
It's just a damn shame because I think macro effect of all of these actions that are happening, all these little events, add up to a chilling effect for certain people getting into journalism, which is the kind of staid, even-tempered, even-handed journalists who want to do the real work and get in there. They're kind of warded off this because it's basically, you know, increasingly getting into a war zone for very little pay. And the people who get very attracted to these kind of environments are high drama, highly partisan, kind of very biased hacks who just want to write hit pieces for, I was going to say BuzzFeed, but actually their news and political teams have had good stuff. But you know who I'm talking about. The kind of online tabloid outlets.
Yeah, when and you know, look, half the journalists I know, I mean, who do politics, do, you know, human aspects of politics too. They're not just doing like the here's what's going on the Hill. They're going out and meeting real people who are impacted by these things and they're by policies that are enacted in Washington, and they want to empathize. I mean, because that's what helps you tell a better story. If you can put yourself in somebody else's shoes and you can see what they're afraid of and you can verbalize that anxiety for other people, it humanizes something that might otherwise be this sort of like faceless, abstracted principle or policy problem. And when those people don't trust you, they don't trust you with as much of their story, which means, you know, they're getting misserved by the media, not because the media wants to misserve them, but because they're deliberately fostering this antagonistic relationship. And then that just sort of like, you know, like that becomes its own vicious cycle. You know, the presumption of objectivity is that your empathy can take you wherever it's most deserving. You know, like you're not going in there divorcing yourself from the principles that you believe in. Like, you know, when you leave the interview, you're still going to believe in the things you believe in. But if you if you're trying very hard to remain within, you know, the ethics and guidelines, both of what you should do professionally, but also what you should do to be a good writer and a good storyteller, you're going to put that aside for however long you're talking to these people and really give them the chance to tell you the things that keep them awake at night and the things that keep them proud of themselves and their family. And if they're just sitting there making you think like, are they going for a weapon when they're digging around behind their back? Like, you're not thinking of them as a person. You're thinking of them as a threat or an antagonist. And that just, I mean, that's going to have, that's a downside for everybody. It's a lose-lose for everybody. And these people, their leaders have said, like, that's okay. I mean, they haven't said it explicitly, but they've created a climate in which, you know, the press has been so dehumanized, like, as a start, and in some cases just absolutely, you know, villainized, that, like, you know, that level of aggression wouldn't be inappropriate for the threat that the press poses. You know, I could... Sorry.
My sole hope for this, I know you're invested in this because you're part of that team, but my sole hope for this is that finally in 2017 we have a tipping point where our pinko communist journalists can finally get behind the Second Amendment and start really personally investing in conceal and carry. God created man, Samuel Colt made them equal. You know what I'm saying?
I like walk into everything just like, hey, you know, and just open up the jacket and you've got the
hey, what's up? I'm a journalist.
Your press badge.
Here's my ID. Here's my cult.
You got your press badge hanging from your pocket protector, and then your CCW weapon there under the hip.
Oh, boy. Sad state of affairs. Let's leave it there for a tick, Jeb, and we'll come back and talk about some smaller politics, shall we?
CBS squad, as you know, we were waiting to make your decision about healthcare until you saw the bill and it just came out.
And we'll talk to you about that later.
Yeah, but there's not going to be time. I'm just curious if you have a
speak
right
with
now.
Shane, please.
But you
I'm sick and tired of you guys. The last Jesus time you came here, you did the same thing. Get the hell out of here.
Jesus.
Get the hell out of here. The last guy did the same thing. You were the guardian?
Yes, and you just broke my glasses.
The last guy did the same damn thing.
You just body slammed me and broke my glasses?
Welcome back to Politics, about dicks and the bigger dicks who roll over those smaller dicks.
Hello.
Which dick are you? If we were trying to divvy up the smart and dumb person at the start, then you have to pick if you're a bigger dick or a smaller dick being ruled by the bigger dicks, Jeb.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. In my head, we are all the smaller dicks and we're commenting on the bigger dicks. We've got an election coming up in New Zealand. I just wanted to round off the podcast this week by just touching on a couple of smaller things that are going on. Well, not necessarily smaller, definitely in my case in New Zealand, but just some other political things that are happening. We've got an election coming up in a few months. I think it's in September from memory, and it looks like our centre-right government led by the National Party is probably going to stay in again. I think this will be... I really should know this, their fifth term, which I'm pretty sure is historic. New Zealand generally has a pretty short attention span, and we like to give the parties anywhere between 2 and 4 consecutive terms before we will turn on them for getting bored. But the opposition, the centre-left opposition in this country is not good. It's suffering a bit of a crisis of leadership at the moment, and just in terms of like a really recent local event that's happened, National brought out the budget, which we do annually here, and there was a lot more goodies for middle class and families of New Zealand than anyone was expecting, and it's taken the wind right out of our centre-left's party's sail, which is that in New Zealand that's the Labour Party, and Labour have just failed even now to articulate a response to this budget, which came out 4 or 5 days ago. They actually did manage to find one bit, which was through the different tax credits that are given out based on how many kids you have and what your circumstances. They've come up with a line about a single child tax, because if you have one kid, through the different programs that are out there and tax benefits and stuff, I think you're going to be slightly worse off, and everyone else is quite a bit better off under the new budget. So basically National's been quietly accruing a bit of surplus, and now they're giving it all out to win another election, which is not a stupid thing to do.
If I may, is the penalty, does that apply to, is it only families with one child, whereas like childless and ones with multiple children are better off, or is it any children period?
It's specifically families that have one child, and I unfortunately haven't dug through the policy in great detail, but we've got a tax credit system here called Working for Families that was actually introduced by the last Labour government, led by Helen Clark, who's at the UN now. And it's basically just a set of tax incentives and tax relief for families, people with kids. And Labour has attempted to make hay out of something that it's dubbed the single child tax, which is just by virtue of the changes that are happening, where most people are going to be a lot better off. It's not going to be very advantageous to be in a position where you are a two-parent family with one child now through the tax system. But, I mean, I think it's pretty nominal. I wish I had more detail. I really should. But that's what's happening here at the moment. So it looks like National, unless something pretty dramatic happens, will sail to another victory. Even the Greens, who have traditionally been a quite out there left party, they used to run like when I was a teenager, when I was quite a bit younger, they used to run really strongly on a legalized cannabis platform with kind of environmental issues sprinkled in there as well. And over the years, they've kind of matured and evolved into a more center chasing party, which I think has actually been great. They've got people like economists who have risen to the top and become co-leaders, and they've still kind of kept a lot of their core ethics and morals. They've got some really cool rules about how the party is ruled. There's two leaders at all times, and it's got to be a male and a female at the top. And they've got a lot of mandates about in their list, their ranking list, they've got to have a certain quota of young people that are in the top 15 and different things like that, quotas that they have to make for diverse representation. So they're kind of a cool party, and they're doing a lot better year after year by kind of coming to the centre. But I'm just starting to hear a bit of sentiment now bubbling up in the letters to the editor and that about, people are feeling that they're selling out a little bit now and not going as hardcore on environmental issues as they used to, which is, the trade-off that you make. But that's what's happening in New Zealand. And the UK is probably the way more exciting one because they're about to have an election on the 8th of June.
I have an important question about this. The Green leaders, has anybody written a rom-com about the man and the woman falling in love yet?
I'm not aware of any fan fiction about that incredibly niche subject, but I'm sure there's a market for it.
Because that's a long, policy-heavy meet-cute, and I can't think of anybody more qualified to handle this kind of task than you and me. So let this podcast constitute a record stipulating that Tim and I have dibs on the New Zealand Green Party leadership rom-com.
We get to option the rights on that, huh?
Yeah.
We've got right of refusal.
Basically, yeah. I mean, it's like the whole bit that you guys do in The Worst Idea of All Time when you come in and you pitch something, except it's already greenlit and nobody else can do it.
Greenlit being the operative word. That's good stuff. The UK election's creeping up as well, Jeb. That's on the 8th of June. And Jeremy Corbyn, who everyone had kind of written off until real recently, is sort of surging in the polls now, and the gap's closing a lot because it seems like Theresa made a couple of false steps recently. I keep seeing this headline about a dementia tax, and I haven't read up on what that actually is. I don't know if you've seen stuff about that, Jeb.
The stuff I keep seeing it is just about, like, you know, her trying to attack Corbyn on you know, like, well, where's the money going to come from and where does it go? And almost like her budget is hugely reliant on just taking money from other parts of the budget and going, well, this program is solvent. It's the same kind of shell game that Bobby Jindal played with the budget in Louisiana before cratering it. And it's the same kind of game that Scott Walker has had to play in Wisconsin to get, like, well, we're going to lower your taxes and we're going to keep all the same services and we're going to keep the budgets balanced. And what they do is they raid rainy day funds, take stuff and basically calculate it. You know, stuff that is one-time only revenue and pretend like it is an annual thing that they can come back to when, in fact, you spend it's gone. Yeah. And just this is something I think Americans have been used to for a long time, like getting the lecture about, you know, we're the party of responsibility. We're basically like dad handling the pocketbook, and dad has a gambling and cocaine problem and just wrapped his Maserati around a stripper, which I don't know how that happened, right? And, like, meanwhile, Corbyn, who they've tried to portray as a radical, has, like, this radical notion that you can tax people who make money. And, like, and it's been really funny to see, like, everybody saying this guy is out of step. He's never going to cut it in politics. And like, he and Sanders both anticipated that there's going to be this sort of toxic blend of racism and populism that's fueled in large part by people being dropped out of the economy and you know, having no choice but to basically be a greeter at whatever the UK version of Walmart is. I assume it's basically just a really, really large asshole Tesco's, but
I have no more information in my bank about the UK election, but it's one that I'm probably going to read up a lot on overnight tonight, just to get up with the play on that, because it does seem to be getting increasingly interesting as it draws closer to election night in the UK.
I did,
so,
like,
let's see how that goes.
I did like the cravenness. I felt it was craven of we're putting the armed forces out on the streets in response to the Manchester suicide bombing, which, I mean, England has, like, God bless England for having that the typical, you know, British phlegm in response to terror attacks and not giving terrorists this sort of, like, glittering worldwide attention for, oh my God, look at the devastation they committed. And it really felt like May was pushing the look how strong and responsive we are in the run-up to the election button by putting folks in uniform out on the streets everywhere in response. I mean, it just seems so disproportionate.
I got that feel as well, that the people of Manchester City are really banding together in a wonderful way and sort of taking to the streets in solidarity for decentness. And it does feel like Theresa May and the Tories are trying to gin up this very American-flavoured response to a devastating tragedy that happened. But it seems like the actual people, the people of Manchester, are, you know, responding in a really mature and kind of wonderful way of all kind of coming together and looking after each other in a very community-focused way. And Theresa May is trying to sort of replicate this heavy-handed iron fist response where everyone rallies around, like a strong military leader. And you're right, it just feels very manufactured. And that, I mean, for all your faults, man, there's something really wonderful about that culture of the British way, that stiff upper lip, that keep calm and carry on attitude of we've been through a lot and we're not going to get disproportionately rattled or upset by some mentally deranged people who do some terrible, terrible things. Yeah. We will mourn and we will look after each other, but we're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater, which unfortunately seems to be in kind of the modern age, the very American response to these sorts of attacks. And I just don't know if it's going to play. And it seems to be a contributing factor to the tightening of the polls between the Conservatives and Labour in the UK, that Theresa May seems like culturally a little bit out of step with the general populace. But I guess we will find out.
Yeah, I made it through. A friend of mine actually phrased it this way. I'm lifting his phrasing. He says, I managed to make it through the whole day without getting upset about the Manchester bombing, except in the that kind of like abstracted, this is reprehensible, and I'm sorry that people died, and I'm sorry that they are hurt. But in a way that without emotionally engaging, and just seeing this guy with the slightly wonky dentition and a bald head and thick Mancunian accent saying, he came down to the blood bank to see if he could donate blood because that's what he could do. And he was so pleased to see there was no sitting. It was standing room only and there wasn't standing room. So he just asked if he could help out by filling out the form and leaving it and coming back to donate later. And they said, thanks, absolutely, that would be great. And he said, great. So I've just been walking around the streets trying to smile at everybody. And
man,
like, yeah, and the same thing happened to me. I had managed to hold it together until I saw that. And then, yeah.
Yeah. People are so much better than their leaders. I think that's a universal thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And then, I mean, so this happened. I don't know if you saw this. There was a fatal dual stabbing in Portland on a train, Portland, Oregon. A guy who has a criminal record and allegedly was radicalized, maybe in prison, but had a history of showing up to public events and screaming white supremacist things, was yelling at these two women of color, one of whom was wearing hijab, on the train and saying, like, I'm a taxpayer, you people don't do anything and you take all this. And three people got up and basically made a wall between this man and the women and tried to de-escalate it. And he cut two of their throats and they died. Mm. And another guy made it through and he's got like this 9-inch long gash running from his ear down to his throat. And, that was another thing where I was processing it sort of objectively. And then sort of the stories came out about, one of the guys who did it was, he had three daughters and he was an army, he was a military veteran. And then the younger kid whose name I won't even attempt to pronounce, although I might actually get it right on the third try. He was this 20 something guy and he went to Reed College, which is kind of a running joke from my college, is sort of like our Northeastern campus, that and Evergreen College are sort of like the Northwestern divisions of our school. And he could have been any one of a couple of dozen kids I went to college with. Long hair, fun, difficult to pronounce name, really outgoing. And supposedly the last thing he said before he died was, tell everyone on the train that I love them.
Man.
Yeah.
Well, that's a hopeful thing. It's sad. It's incredibly sad. But yeah, and we should round off on this, but I just want to get this out because it has kind of been rolling around in my head since the Manchester bombing happened, is that, like, I think we've collectively, and particularly people in the news, have to stop being so keen to attach political and cultural ideologies to these people. Like, I think if you engage in that kind of bloodshed and make that decision to go and kill people, like, you're not part of the discourse. You're not part of a political conversation that's going on. You're deranged. Like, you're outside of what we would take into account to make our decisions about how we're going to live our lives. And I just think that all of this stuff about seeing that people were, you know, screaming that the guy was a Bernie bro who was who committed the horrific stabbings in Oregon.
Like the ass load of cynical shit that has jammed up the Clintonistas that do that is like, that is actually, I was more pissed about that than the fact that our president didn't say shit about, you know, a veteran and a, you know, a young college student dying trying to protect someone's First Amendment rights. Like,
It swings both ways as well, because I know that there's kind of a line of sensibleness in here somewhere, but it does swing both ways in that I'm sure that we would be, both of us, Jeb, guilty of engaging in a similar thing with, you know, gun fanatics and people on the right in there and attaching an ideology and kind of painting, you know, GOP voters with this brush more than they deserve. So I just think, yeah, we need to kind of rein that shit in. These people who commit these atrocities are deranged, and I don't think that we should keep including them in kind of political and cultural conversations. I think they need to be removed from that because it's just not helpful, and I think it radicalizes people, and I think it's part of this whole thing of us becoming increasingly polarized and not being able to communicate with each other, and it's not good.
See, and I think that there's a completely valid thing to want to believe, and I think it's a heartwarming thing to want to believe on to a certain extent, but like terrorism, acts of terror are, you know, like Clausewitz said, you know, war is the continuation of diplomacy by other means. Well, political violence is the continuation of political policy by other means. Now, this guy might have been unstable. The guy in Portland, the guy in Manchester might well have been unstable. But these are people that are they're pawns that get radicalized by a political intent, and causing other people to be afraid of them advances a political intent. And like, you know, and you know, there are great examples of that being successful too. I mean, like, I think the members and leaders of Sinn Féin would argue that violence, like meted out in certain measured ways, like does heighten sympathy or at least heighten the urgency of seeking a political resolution to an issue. So like, while these guys, felt that they were, you know, like, if I commit these murders, I create an urgency that makes the legislature do something more rapidly. But they are the end stage user of a kind of rhetoric that says, you know, non-white people don't belong here. Muslims, especially, you can identify them by their outward garments. They are a religion of violence and conquest. You know, if you go in the right-wing fever swamps, pedophilia and sexual servitude and, you know, sexual slavery, you know, that program, I mean, decades long, but mostly intensified since 2001, of dehumanization of these people creates that end user. And the, you know, the people who create that end user have no problem with it, because, you know, every time that something like that is successful and makes that person famous, I think, you know, it inspires somebody else, and it creates that urgency among liberals to maybe not fight it as much, because you don't know when you're going to get, you know, when you're going to be the one on the train between the target and the angry patriot. I don't know. Like, I come at this from like a far more cynical space, I think, because I don't think it's a mistake that these people get created, except, you know, in cases where they maybe lack the mens rea to understand what they're doing. You know, that they might be, like, somewhat not neurotypical or vastly undereducated, or they get put in a place like prison where they have to become, you know, if they want to survive, if it has a strong violent gang culture, they may have to ally themselves with white nationalists to make it through. But you know, that there are people who profit from this and have no problem with creating the rhetorical conditions that make this seem like a necessary step. And that is a bigger discussion, I think. I mean, I can't take my, I don't think I can take myself out of that, but that's.
Yeah. It. Well, we will, I'm sure, keep talking about this when inevitably the next awful thing happens. But we've gone so over time. Jeb, always a goddamn pleasure talking to you, man.
Yeah, especially, you know, you let me at the end, like you just said something and I went, no, Tim, no.
And that's fair enough.
It's,
you can't just say, I'll quickly mention this and make it a real big, meaty, you know, bell for you to chase.
But it's very gentlemanly of you. You know, you invite me, you know, you have me onto this podcast and you put in more labor than I do. At the end of it, I just go, no.
This is our podcast, Jeb. This is my podcast. All right, everybody. We will hopefully catch you in a week's time. Jeb, where can we see and follow you?
Well, I Mobute on Twitter, Mobute, or on my Facebook page, Jeb Lund's Word Salad.
And I am Tim_Bat, B-A-T-T, on Twitter. And I've got a comedian page on Facebook, which is not really worth following unless you're in New Zealand and want to know when I'm gigging. So I'll just leave that there. Okay, catch you soon, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
NATO members must finally contribute their fair share and meet their financial obligations. This is not fair to the people and taxpayers of the United States, and many of these nations owe massive amounts of money from past years and not paying in those past years. Over the last 8 years, the United States spent more on defense than all other NATO countries combined.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.